Welcome to this episode of PageCast, a books podcast brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's book is the definitive account of Commando, a Boer journal of the Anglo-Boer War, published word for word as Raitt first wrote it, edited and annotated by historian and Anglo-Boer War expert, Professor Frans Johan Pretorius. In this episode of PageCast, Professor Pretorius is interviewed by Cape Talk Afternoon Drive presenter John Matham. Enjoy.
Hello, reader. This is another edition of PageCast. I am John Matham, and it is a particularly big pleasure for me to be talking to Frans Johan Pretorius, who has edited a new edition of Denise Raitt's absolutely wonderful book, Commando, a Boer Journal of the Anglo-Boer War. I say a particular pleasure because I did the audio recording of this book, and it meant that I had to pay it particular attention, even more than I would have as an ordinarily diligent reader, and was struck anew, having read it a couple of times before, but struck anew by just how powerful a war book it is. Frans Johan Pretorius, a very, very, very big hello to you.
Oh, yes. Hello, John. Thank you for this interview.
Let's get on to the book in just a little while. But for those people who don't know the name Denise Raitt, don't know the history of, haven't encountered Commando before, just a little bit of history on who this man was.
Yes, young Denise Raitt was born in 1882, so when the Anglo-Boer War, or South African War, broke out in 1899, he was 17. He was the middle son of five sons of F.W. Raitt's first marriage to a Norwegian woman, Blanca Thesen, from Nisna. And his father, F.W. Raitt, was a well-known Afrikaans poet, already one of the firsts in the 1870s. He then became the state president of the Orange Free State in the 1890s. He resigned in 1895 because of his ill health, but in 1898, he became the state secretary of the Transvaal of President Paul Kruger. And it was in this capacity that F.W. Raitt went through the Anglo-Boer War. Now, young Denise was educated and, mark my words, at Grey College in Bloemfontein. I say Grey College because I wasn't at that school, so I can mention it very easily. But Grey College. And then in June 1899, he matriculated at Grey College. But as a young boy, he and his brothers, they enjoyed the veld. They became good horsemen. They became part of the veld. They could live on the veld. So when the war broke out, he was already there and part of it. But then after his matriculation in June 1899, he came to Pretoria, where his father was the state secretary, and he enrolled for engineering at the Staatsgymnasium, the state gymnasium. And then the war broke out. So he went on commando, and he enjoyed life. You know, he was a very, very interesting young guy. He was like a resilient cork. The deeper you press him into the water, the higher he emerged. So he was what I call an everywhere man, because he was just all over the space in this war. He was a well-connected young man because his father, being in on the executive council of the Transvaal government, he walked in the corridors of the government building on Church Square. He knew Paul Kruger, Commandant General Piet Joubert, State Attorney Jan Smuts. You name them, he knew them all, and they knew him. So he was really within the very part of everybody who knew about what was going on in government circles. But he was also this young, brave burgher who was staunch and erudite and a good man of the veld. So this everywhere man was the guy who you find in all spheres of this war. Commando is only his experiences of the war. So it's not a history of the Anglo-Boer War, but his angle to that. But this is so fascinating because he's this adventurous spirit. He is this man full of going to all places. He finds himself on all fronts with all events. And then he's this magnificent wordsmith, a young guy who became this fantastic writer who tells us about things that you cannot believe happened in such a wonderful English style.
Then I said it was an extraordinary experience being able to read this book as an audiobook, because it brought me to the text in a very specific and very detailed and very focused way. And as you say, he was in Natal, he was in the Free State, he was in the battles around Johannesburg and Pretoria, he was in the Northern Cape, he was in the Eastern Cape, he was up in the West Coast into the sort of Galfinia area, the Hantankaru, and so on. And what struck me was his, perhaps the word is insouciance, I don't know if that's the correct word, but this kind of attitude of, this is war, I'm living it, it's terrible, but I'm not going to be bowed down by the terribleness of it. There is no bitterness towards the foes that he is fighting particularly. And I mean, we've sort of touched on what makes this book unique, but perhaps expand on what makes this account of this war such a very special event in the history of writing about war.
Yes, most definitely this is an international classic. You can compare it with Tolstoy if you like. I'll be so bold as to do that. And even Remarque with his All Quiet on the Western Front. This kind of very personal story. You know, you read a sentence and you look up and you say, can this be true? Or just look how well he pins this down, and you say, I can relate to all what he writes. And you start becoming enthusiastic and you read every sentence, you gulp it up. It's just a wonderful, wonderful story.
Particularly given that he was so young during the experiencing of it and the writing of it. It's an extraordinarily mature book for somebody so young, but then maybe his youth allowed him to have the attitude towards the war, to the fighting, to the privations that he and his fellow burghers had to enjoy. Perhaps it was his youth that allowed him to be so, not carefree, that's not the right word, but to be so seemingly unaffected by it at a deep level.
Yes, I think it's because of the intelligence of the Raitz family. He is very much in control of what he feels, what he sees, what he experiences. And it's just mind-boggling that he was able, at this young age, age of 21, to write down the memoirs at first. It's something that you cannot believe, that a young man of 21 is able to write such a story with so much empathy, sympathy, humor, and jest. And it's really, if you haven't read this book, it's something that you must read. It's a South African must read.
The history of the manuscript, written it's written almost 100 years ago now. This is the new edition. What happened with the original publication? What has happened to the text since then?
When the war ended in May 1902, Dinesh Raitz's father, F.W., wasn't prepared to sign the oath of allegiance to the British Crown. So he went off to the Netherlands. And Dinesh and his younger brother, Arendt, decided to do that as well and not sign the oath of allegiance. And they went off to Madagascar, where they became transport drivers for the next few years. They worked very, very hard. They toiled, and they didn't enjoy that very much. But once again, their spirit was something that ensured that they were to be successful there as well. And it was there that he started writing his memoirs in original Dutch, High Dutch. Occasionally, there's the Afrikaans word slipping in, because remember, Afrikaans was the spoken language of the Boers at the time already. And it is a manuscript of 1147 pages, written pages, that he did. And then in 1929, it was published in English. In other words, 27 years after the war. But now he was this mature wordsmith who could tell us in English his innermost feelings. And this edition was by Faber and Faber in London, 1929. I see that there are some written remarks by himself correcting his manuscript, and also by, I think, N.J. de Wet, who was the military secretary of General Louis Botha during the Anglo-Boer War. He later became the Chief Justice of South Africa. And so there was some revision there, but not much. And then eventually it was published in 1929. Young de Nys had now, by 1929, become this mature wordsmith, somebody whom you could rely on to give you the best there is.
So what was published in 1929 differs very little from what he wrote 20 years and more before. So even though he was now this mature, excellent wordsmith, the manuscript still, to a large degree, represents the youthful de Nys Reits, the "I've just finished fighting, now I'm putting it down on paper" de Nys Reits.
That's exactly what happened. Yes, it is the youthful Reits telling us in 1929, when he was 47, it is telling us what he felt and experienced as a young boy of 17, 18, 19 during the war.
And a new edition, what made you want to do it?
The reason for that is very interesting. The CEO of Jonathan Ball, Eugene Ashton, grew up, like myself, with Commando as one of his cherished books. And he always wanted to have another edition, because in 1983, Jonathan Ball Publishers did this edition, which was republished in 1990. And he wanted this something special. And now Eugene was a student of mine at the University of Pretoria, first year student, and then in the honors section doing my course on the Anglo-Boer War. And he approached me to say, can you give explanatory footnotes, annotations to this manuscript? And I enjoyed it immensely. Because, you know, this is, having grown up with this and knowing it so well, I could add my experience of 55 years of research on the Anglo-Boer War, I could add to that. And by the way, there was an Afrikaans edition in the 1930s, Commando. And I have a French edition as well. Oui. So it is a very popular book, but let's get back to where we are. So then I started doing annotations. I thought initially, yes, about 200, but eventually there are 433 annotations giving context to the book, giving context to remarks that young de Nys Reits made, and that is giving extra, because with his experience, only his experience, it doesn't tell us what's going on in the rest of the war or why he mentions something. If you allow me, I will mention a few examples. He mentions that their field cornet, Pieter Sederberg, of the Pretoria town commander, was a very brave man. At Spionkop, for instance, and we learn to cherish the relationship between young Reitz and Sederberg. But what Danais doesn't add is when Lord Roberts occupies Pretoria in June 1900, Sederberg, who's part of the coaching company in all directions from Pretoria and Johannesburg, Sederberg lays down his arms. He becomes a Hanseoper. He takes the oath of neutrality. And in December 1900, when Lord Kitchener starts with the Burgher Peace Committee to persuade the burghers on commando to lay down their arms, he becomes a member of that. So he becomes a joiner, a collaborator with the British. And this is not mentioned in the text of Young Danais Reds. So that's the kind of context that I try to give with my explanatory footnotes. There's another one, for instance. Reds mentions in his work that after the Jameson raid of 1895 to 96, the Transvaal started to arm because they realized there might be a war coming with British imperialism playing a part. Then I give a context saying that a survey in 1896 revealed that more than 40% of the Boers did not possess rifles. And those that did had antiquated old rifles. So from the Great Trek and from the 1960s, 70s, the First Anglo-Boer War, so Pietersburg started arming. And when the war broke out, they had 37,000 Mausers and as many Martini Henrys and several artillery pieces. So that kind of context is given, which Young Danais doesn't give. May I add a third one? When Jan Smuts invades the Cape Colony in September 1901, starts there in the Eastern Cape near Herschel over the Orange River, and then to the Midlands, Cape Midlands, the Western Cape, and up to the northwestern Cape eventually, he doesn't mention how many they are. And there I say, well, originally they were 360 men crossing the Orange River, but soon Commandant Pieter Wessels with 140 men returned to the Free State. So they were 220 burghers. And this helps the reader to say, okay, they so many, and yet the British didn't manage to capture them. They tried all over. General Haig, General French, who were to become famous generals in the First World War, they were just not able to get hold of Jan Smuts, who was extremely good as a guerrilla fighter.
If I may say, as a reader, that I found the footnotes, the annotations, incredibly helpful. Generally, I tend to skip over annotations. Oh, he has an academic interfering. But these I did. They gave me the context that you have been talking about. So they are, for me, an extremely useful addition to Reitz's wonderful storytelling. You mentioned earlier, Franz Johann, sort of reading it and going, can this be true? And still, one thinks of that. Can this be true? To what extent might he have exaggerated the bravery, the privation, all of those kind of almost boy's own adventurous exploits that he is detailing as having taken place in the midst of a very bitter war? Is there any doubt about the credulity of what he tells us?
Well, in the first place, I found that 99% of what he writes is what he experienced. And very seldom is there a factual error. If I may mention, at the beginning he writes that at the age of 17 he was too young to be mobilized for a military service, which is incorrect, because at the time the commando laws of both the Transvaal and the Orange Free State were that at the age of 16 you were liable for military service. So yes, whether you regard him as a Free State burgher or a Transvaal burgher, he was liable for military service. So that wasn't correct. And then there are a few other mistakes that he makes. For instance, at the Battle of Magersfontein, where he wasn't present, he makes the mistake of saying that British officer commanding was General Wauchop or Wauchop, the Scottish leader, but it was actually Lord Methven. Wauchop was the leader of the Highland Brigade at Magersfontein. So there are small errors. He says that his father voted for peace at Vereeniging, but that's not correct. He was not one of the 60 delegates there. He was the state secretary and present, but he wasn't one of the members who had to vote, do we accept the British peace proposals or not? So small little errors creep in. And then occasionally you find, or I found, that he claims too much. One example is that he gives this very famous quotation at the Battle of Nicholson's Neck. And by the way, Rates only calls it the Battle of Ladysmith, but I, in my footnotes, distinguish between the Battle of Modderspruit and Nicholson's Neck on the same day to the east and the north of Ladysmith. And he's originally in the north at Nicholson's Neck. And then he says, from there they could see the battle raging at Modderspruit. And then the British are defeated and forced to retreat, actually flee towards Ladysmith. And afterwards, General Pithubert was castigated because he didn't pursue them with his horsemen and, you know, wipe them out and made a change to the war. And Denise Rates then says that he was near in the presence of General De Wet on Nicholson's Neck, who, according to him, muttered, "Lose your horsemen, lose your horsemen." In other words, attack those retreating British by horse. And that is not in his original Dutch manuscript. So where does it come from? Did he pick it up from one of the men who were there? Or did he forget to write it in 1903 and remembered, oh, I need to add that into my story in 1929. So there are a few inconsistencies. And then one or two negative remarks about the British were not included in the 1929 edition. In general, he has high regard for the British officers and soldiers. He mentions only one British officer whom he didn't like. And for the rest, he was always there to talk to prisoners of war, and he enjoyed their company, learned from them, and things like that. But there's one very interesting remark where he says that on coming from the northwestern Cape towards the Transvaal to come for the peace discussions, he meets up with General Smuts. They meet up with Lord Kitchener. And he then describes this guy with his red face. It's clear that he drinks too much. But that sentence is not in the final edition.
You mention his respect for the fighting qualities of the British. And one of the things that struck me, I remember it striking me when I first read it, the book probably 35, 40 years ago, I first read it. And it came home to me with even greater force reading it as an audiobook. His lack of bitterness, his lack of an obvious hatred. I mean, this was a difficult war. It was a war of liberation for those who were fighting it. It was a war of oppression. It was a war which has left very deep wounds on the psyche of many South Africans. There's a kind of generational trauma associated with it. But none of that is in Rates's writing. With the exception of that senior British officer that you mentioned, he is respectful. And yes, he does mention the terrible concentration camp policy, the scorched earth policy, but he does so without the kind of obvious anger and vitriol and you know, strong negative emotions that you might have assumed he would have associated with it. That speaks to his character.
Yes, yes, that is very striking. I think it's this, you know, this broad-minded, mature young man that you cannot believe, who is so well-balanced, so level-headed. I mean, going through all of those experiences, if you read the book, And yet he comes up with a very level-headed story in 1903, straight after the war. You would expect bitterness, like with other Afrikaner nationalists coming up with titles in the 1930s like Helkampe or Mag ons vergeet, lest we forget, things like that. That makes him very exceptional. But one must remember that there were some Afrikaners who were already South Africans by 1902. And this, I think, is part of that. I was so impressed by this young man who revealed a broad-mindedness and a love of humanity that you cannot expect normally from a 21-year-old man.
Perhaps we can have a couple of your favorite stories from the many stories in the book. One of my favorites is when he overhears the two British officers having been captured at a battle and talking about these Afrikaners. And that's just ridiculous that in the thin clothing and so on, that, and look at that one, they say, pointing at Raitz. And how can you keep believing that you're going to win this war? And he says, well, you know, I'm like Micawber. I will think that something will turn up. And they're completely taken aback that the fact that this, I don't know, this ragamuffin in front of them can quote Dickens at them. That's my favorite story. Well, one of my favorites. Perhaps a couple of yours?
Yes, well, that incident happened in December 1900 at the Battle of Nooitgedacht in the Magaliesberg, close to the now Hartbeespoort Dam and Rustenburg. And Raitz was on top of the mountain with Beyers and them, and they wiped out the Northumberland Fusiliers at the top of the mountain, and he was going down the kloof there towards the fighting that was going on with Delarey and Smuts and others on the plains. And as he was going down, as you say, he saw two wounded British officers. And as he approached them, he heard the one saying, "Now here comes this typical Boer for you. Let us ask him, why do they continue the war?" And as you say, the answer from Charles Dickens's David Copperfield. He says, "It's like Mr. Micawber. We're waiting for something to turn up." In other words, they were hoping for a European intervention in the war to stop the war. That's a favorite story, but it's also so vivid because on top of the mountain, where he tells us that vivid collections of fighting hand to hand with fists and with rifle butts against those British on top in the middle of the night. So that's one of my favorite stories, Nooitgedacht. But then Spionkop in January 1900, because there young Raitz goes up the mountain with a Pretoria commander. His fellow combatants had already gone up before him, Sederberg and his tent mates. And his description of running up Spionkop from the northern side and then seeing his tent mates dead or seriously wounded or mortally wounded, men who had slept with him in the tent that night. And when he reaches the top and there's hand-to-hand cuff fighting again, and they retreat, and then the battle starts 20 meters apart. It's something that a reader who hasn't done that must go and read. I think my third favorite one is the Battle of Eland's River Poort or Modderfontein in September 1901. Smuts had been in the Eastern Cape for 2 weeks now. They all were in tatters, their clothes. Smuts, young Dinesh Raitz, was wearing a grain sack with three holes in for his head and for his two arms. And they had two or three rounds of ammunition and no food and no sleep. You know, they'd been awake for 72 hours. And then he's part of the advance group that encounter a company of the 17th Lancers at Eland's River Poort. And the battle that he describes is so extremely vivid. And I've been on that battlefield, and you look at all the hills that he describes so well, the ridge in front, the kraal, the house. Oh, it is out of this world. And then, of course, the entire invasion of Smuts from the 3rd of September 1901 to right up to Concordia in the northwestern Cape. You know, he writes about their terrible experience because it was bitterly cold. Horses froze to death. Men were numb. They couldn't move almost, but they had to continue. Otherwise, they were going to be caught. They didn't know what was the outcome of this all, but somewhere, someone, a local inhabitant, found a little road path down an edge of a mountain, the Sierberger or all those Sneeuwberger, and they escaped. And all of this, you know, when they encounter the cycads, broodboom, that they thought we could eat, and they all became extremely ill. And Smuts had to be put on his horse and carried by two men on both sides. And they suffered for a few days after that. And then when you read that the worst was yet to come, and you say, is that possible? And then you read, yes, it was possible.
Yes, his ability to write not just about war and the conduct of war and the battles and describe them in a way that makes them come absolutely alive, to use the listener, but that tiny little detail of everyday life, the cold, the hunger, when it rains, the terrible wet and not being able to get dry, and the mud, and all of those things are so exquisitely done. It was the first in a trilogy, because he then later on wrote Trekking On, and after that, No Outspan. So there's this famous trilogy of the Boer War and its aftermath. But I don't think too many people would argue against the fact that Commando is the most vivid, the most memorable of the three. A little bit more about what happened with Denys Reitz after the events described in Commando and written about on Madagascar, his latter life.
Yes. May I just add to what you've said about his the minute things that happened on Commando? I did my PhD on life on Commando during the Anglo-Boer War, and Reitz was one of those sources that was so helpful about everyday thoughts, everyday events, even picking up British cartridges along the way because they had no ammunition and they had to use British Lee Metfords. Yes, so what a wonderful book for giving us a glance on life on Commando as you'd never have experienced before. But the rates after the war, being this laborer on Madagascar with his brother, it was hard work. And then he became ill. I think it was malaria. And Mrs. Issy Smuts, the wife of General Smuts, beckoned him to come back and persuaded him to come back to South Africa in 1905. He needn't have to take the oath of allegiance. He came back, and as a protege of Smuts, he actually lived with them for quite a while. So young Reitz then went to live with Smuts and his wife, not yet at Irene, Doornkloof, because that only started in 1909, but in Sunnyside with Smuts and his wife. And in 1908, he became an attorney in Heilbronn in the Orange Free State. So he returned to where he actually was born, and the Free State. In the First World War, he served on the staff of General Smuts in German Southwest Africa, today Namibia. And from there, he followed Smuts to the German East Africa, where he actually commanded the 4th South African Horse. Afterwards, in 1917, he went to the Western Front in Europe, where he was severely wounded twice, and he ended up the war as a colonel in a battalion of the 1st Royal Scottish Fusiliers. In 1919, he married Leela Wright. Now, Leela became the first woman member of parliament, a very formidable woman. And then in 1920, he became a member of parliament under Smuts, who was the prime minister, and also a member of Smuts's cabinet, a member of Minister of Lands. Then he left politics. He was outvoted. In 1929, he returned as a member of parliament. And in 1933, he became a member of General Herzog's cabinet, Minister of Agriculture and Forestry, and then the Mines, and then Native Affairs, and the Deputy Prime Minister in 1938. And in 1943, he was sent as the South African High Commissioner to London, where, unfortunately, he died the next year in October 1944. He was buried in the Eastern Transvaal, Mpumalanga now, very near the Blader River Port area.
An extraordinary life, and one of the most extraordinary parts of it was his role in the Anglo-Boer War, which he details so vividly, so impressively, in Commando, a Boer journal of the Anglo-Boer War. And I have been talking to the man, historian Frans-Jan Pretorius, who put this together with those very, very useful annotations. And the book is available in all good bookstores at the moment, and I really do advise people who are listening to this PageCast to either buy it and read it or download it and listen to it. Frans-Jan, thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank you very much, John.